people in the U.S. find with their governance system now. What was left out of that analysis, though, was what has happened to the people since. I believe that for hundreds of years, as the system was being rigged, the people of the United States adjusted to the rigging of the system, and so they adjusted themselves. They themselves became rigged along with the rigged system. The only way we can actually have values that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about is that we've got to unrig ourselves. We've got to dig deeply within ourselves and understand who we are, where we are, what our country has lost, and how we can get it back. Finally, the other thing is that not only in this sort of rigging and unrigging, the system has never, the United States has never dealt with some issues like the race issue. And race is easily used. It's the kindling that is always there, that all one has to do is throw a match that has been, but it still has a little spark. And that spark is enough to just combust the entirety of the United States. That is something that has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we will never unrig ourselves, and we will never have the revolution of values that we need, and we will never take our country back.
Well, Dr. Cynthia McKinney, thank you so much for being with me. It has been a pleasure speaking to you here, Hidden Files. The way the alternative media led this fight for my freedom and the way that on social media, hashtag Free Marzia Hashemi went viral were very effective campaigns and say a lot about the potential for alternative voices to play a bigger role in highlighting what is really taking place on the ground globally. What my experience has shown me is that we can and must try to magnify the voice of the voiceless, and we can be effective. We have to dig into files that others don't want to touch, cases that have been ignored because it just wasn't in their interest to portray. And this program is a start. Here, together, we can inspect, inform, and ignite the change that needs to take place so that more stories can have a happy ending like mine, so that people like you and me can have a chance at living a life as a person and not be reduced to yet another statistic, another number. God willing, we will be back with another episode of Hidden Files next week with another story from another corner of this vast world of ours that has so much more going on than the titles from the mainstream media. Stay curious.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov warned on Tuesday, 4th of April, that Finland's NATO membership will force Russia to take countermeasures to ensure our own tactical and strategic security. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Global Times has covered this story and tells us more. With a Finnish flag rising first time outside the NATO headquarters, the Nordic nation officially became NATO's 31st member country at a meeting of the US-led bloc's foreign ministers, including US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, on Tuesday, 4th of April in Brussels, Belgium. A historic shift away from the Nordic nation's traditional policy of neutrality, which Chinese experts believe now pushes Finland to the forefront against Russia and may spur Moscow to boost its nuclear deployment, thus making Europe's overall security landscape even more precarious. Finnish President Sauli Niinistö travelled to Brussels and participated in the official ceremony of his country's accession to NATO on Tuesday, 4th of April. Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto and Defence Minister Antti Kaikkonen also took part in the ceremony. NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg said on Tuesday that from this day on, Finland will get an ironclad security guarantee, as the rule of one for all and all for one now apply to Finland. Finland, along with Sweden, announced their intention to join NATO in May of 2022, just months after the outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. In response, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov warned on Tuesday that Finland's NATO membership will force Russia to take countermeasures to ensure our own tactical and strategic security, as Helsinki's military alignment is an escalation of the situation and an encroachment on Russia's security, according to media reports. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko responded on Monday that Moscow would strengthen its military capacity in its western and northwestern regions. In case of deployment of forces of other NATO members on the territory of Finland, we will take additional steps to ensure Russia's military security, Alexander Grushko said, according to the Russian news site RIA Novosti. For countries caught in between major powers, not taking sides is actually a very rational choice. Kui Heng, an assistant research fellow from the Center for Russian Studies of East China Normal University, told the Global Times on Tuesday, noting that Finland's complete abandonment of its neutrality and putting itself at the forefront of NATO's confrontation against Russia will undoubtedly increase Finland's own security risks instead of reducing them. Now that NATO missiles are very close to Russia, it wouldn't be a surprise if they're deployed to Finland in the future, Kui Heng said. Russia is bound to respond to this new national security concern, Kui Heng added. On the one hand, Russia may intensify its offensive on the battlefield of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and on the other hand, it may continue to strengthen its nuclear weapons deployment. About a year ago, Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council and former Russian president, made a plain warning that if Finland or Sweden joined NATO, Russia would deploy nuclear weapons close to the Baltic states and Scandinavia, and it would not be possible to talk any more about the Baltic non-nuclear status, according to an Agence France-Presse report. Li Haidong, a professor at the Institute of International Relations at the China Foreign Affairs University, told the Global Times on Tuesday that Finland's NATO membership would make the overall security of Europe more precarious. Finland has lost the function of being a bridge between Russia and Europe and has completely taken sides, which proves that the Finnish decision-makers, as well as the Swedish decision-makers, lack strategic vision, Li said. The military confrontation between NATO and Russia will deteriorate, and the possibility of a nuclear conflict between NATO and Russia is on the rise, which will make it more difficult to ensure the security for all European countries. Although some analysts have suggested that Finland's NATO membership would extend NATO's front line with Russia by 1,300 kilometers, which will put more pressure on Russia's northwestern regions, Chinese experts believe that the lengthening of the front line also means NATO will need to invest more defense forces. Russia's conventional weapons already lag behind those of the entire NATO bloc, so there is no need for a massive increase in conventional weapons, Kui Heng, assistant research fellow from the Center for Russian Studies of East China Normal University, said. The main thing that Russia needs against NATO will be nuclear weapons, such as upgrading their nuclear defensive capabilities. It is extremely dangerous and irresponsible for NATO to force Russia to demonstrate its nuclear strength, Li Haidong said. NATO front-loaded its deterrent against Russia by granting Finland NATO membership, and Russia front-loaded its deterrent by deploying nuclear weapons in Belarus. So the two-side strategies are actually quite consistent, Kui Heng said. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. The blue and white flag of Finland has been raised alongside those of its Western partners outside NATO's headquarters in Brussels, Belgium, after the Nordic country formally became the 31st member of NATO. Guests, including the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Finnish President, Foreign and Defense Ministers, applauded and shouted bravo at the ceremony on Tuesday, 4th of April, which marked a historic realignment of Europe's security landscape. It's a great day for Finland and an important day for NATO, said Finland's president, Sauli Niinistö. Russia tried to create a sphere around them, and we're not a sphere. I'm sure Finns themselves feel more secure that we are living in a more stable world. Sweden and Finland, which share a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia, submitted simultaneous membership applications last May, abandoning decades of military non-alignment to seek security as NATO members after a breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. While Turkey last week became the last NATO member to ratify Finland's application, Turkey and Hungary continue to delay Sweden's application for membership of NATO. Ankara accuses Stockholm of sheltering Kurdish militants, while Budapest has grievances about Swedish criticism of the rule of law in Hungary. Finland's president, Sauli Niinistö, said Finland's membership is not complete without that of Sweden, and that persistent efforts for a rapid Swedish membership of NATO continues. Stockholm has said it is not sure it will be able to join NATO before a planned NATO summit next July. Russia Today has also covered this story and tells us more. Finland has officially become the 31st member of NATO. Helsinki's accession was made possible after the Turkish parliament approved the step last Thursday, making it the last country to ratify the expansion of the US-led military bloc. Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto signed the agreement on his country's accession at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium, on Tuesday, 4th of April, before handing it over in a formal ceremony to US Secretary of State Antony Blinken. With receipt of this instrument of accession, we can now declare that Finland is the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty, the top US diplomat proclaimed. The backing of all NATO states is required to admit a new member. Finland's accession had been blocked for months by Turkey. Russia has repeated its warning that it would respond to NATO expansion by beefing up its defences in the northwest of the country. Earlier, Moscow cited NATO's further expansion as one of the reasons for the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that upcoming elections should be a lesson to the U.S. and that from now on, doors are closed to U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Flake, who last week met with Erdogan's main electoral rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. He said, "We need to teach America a lesson in these elections." Joe Biden speaks from there. What is Biden's ambassador doing here? He goes to visit Mr. Kemal. It's a shame. Use your brain. You are the ambassador. Your interlocutor here is the president. He added, "Our doors are now closed to him. You cannot see me anymore. Why? You will know your limits." According to a tweet from the U.S. Embassy, Flake met with Kılıçdaroğlu, the leader of the Republican People's Party, on 29th of March as part of continuing conversations with Turkish political parties on issues of mutual interest between the two countries. Also in early March, Ankara summoned Flake over top U.S. General Mark Milley's visit to northeast Syria. This happened weeks after Turkish Interior Minister slammed the U.S. envoy after Washington warned Ankara about exporting chemicals, microchips, and other products to Russia. Erdogan is fuming over the U.S. envoy's meeting with opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is leading most polls weeks before crucial elections. According to the most recent opinion polls released on March 27th, Kılıçdaroğlu is ahead of Erdogan in voter intention by 2.5 percentage points. These figures show Erdogan has been able to close the gap from earlier in the month when he was lagging by more than 10 percentage points. Four different polling agencies suggest a possible seat change at the presidential palace in Ankara, with Kılıçdaroğlu leading the race with more than 50% of voters' support. In contrast, support for Erdogan stands at 44% on average. Presidential and parliamentary elections in Turkey are scheduled for May 14th. Kılıçdaroğlu was nominated as the presidential candidate by an alliance of the country's six opposition parties. Erdogan and his ruling AK party are expected to face an uphill battle for re-election following the devastating earthquake that killed over 50,000 people in the country in the early February. The U.S. and Turkey, allies and strategic partners on paper, haven't had an easy relationship since 2014 when Washington decided to ally against ISIS with Kurdish militants in Syria, which are viewed as terrorists by Ankara. Since then, two more U.S. administrations have taken power in Washington, yet tensions and occasional shouting matches over a set of issues from Turkey's purchase of Russian-made S-400 air defense systems to Ankara's decision to hold up Sweden's NATO bid have continued. After Ankara made the decision to buy Russian S-400 missile defense systems, the U.S. kicked Turkey off a stealth F-35 fighter jet program. So when Sweden and Finland declared their NATO accession bid, it provided Erdogan with a trump card in his hardball games with Turkey's Western allies. And let's not forget the allegations of U.S. involvement in the attempted coup against Erdogan's government in 2016. These have all fueled an anti-American sentiment in Ankara that views the U.S. as an unreliable ally. In addition, Turkish media has reported that Erdogan might host Russian President Vladimir Putin in the near future for the inauguration of a nuclear power plant. Erdogan has said his country is determined to proceed with the nuclear power plant project despite objection from the opposition. He noted that Putin may either travel to Mersin in person or attend via teleconference. The recent moves to condemn the U.S., give a cold shoulder to the U.S. ambassador, and to embrace Putin might be part of a process of heating up tensions with the U.S. before elections in May.
The regime has carried out yet another airstrike in Syria, this time targeting positions in the western city of Homs. A war monitoring group said explosions rocked the city and fire broke out in a research center. The Syrian military said the country's air defense intercepted several missiles, but the strike injured several soldiers and caused some material damage. The Sunday strike near the city of Homs was Israel's third such attack since last week. The regime carried out two separate attacks near the capital Damascus on Thursday and Friday. Syria was soon to react. In a statement, the Syrian foreign ministry slammed what it called fascist Israeli military attacks, saying the regime is in close coordination with terrorist groups to prolong the crisis in the Arab country. Iran's Revolution Guards Corps, which lost two of its members in Friday's attack, warned Israel of a crushing response. In a statement, the IRGC said, quote, "The crimes of the fake and criminal Zionist Israeli regime will not go unanswered, and it will pay." Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani condemned the attack, saying the blood of the high-ranking martyrs will not go waste, and that Tehran reserves its right to respond at the appropriate time and place. This comes as the regime in Tel Aviv argues that it carries out attacks in Syria to prevent Iran's growing presence. Syria, however, says military cooperation and arms program with Iran are part of a decades-old strategic partnership to withstand Israel's long-term threats. Iran says its officers serve as an advisory role in Syria at the invitation of Damascus. Syria has sent numerous letters to the United Nations calling on the world body to intervene and put an end to Israeli attacks, but almost all those calls have fallen on deaf ears. The international community has failed to even blame the Israeli regime for the losses inflicted on Damascus. The latest Israeli airstrikes in Syria's Homs is the regime's seventh such attack in March, which is an indication that the regime has been raising the number of its aggressions against Syria. But why is the regime increasing the number of its attacks? First and foremost, what seems to be the case is the fact that the Arab world is increasing its engagement with the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. From Egypt to Saudi Arabia, each country has its own reason to resume relations with Damascus. Egypt has set up contacts with Assad, with both sides having agreed to strengthen cooperation during their first official visit by a Syrian foreign minister to Cairo, which is unprecedented in over a decade. According to Egyptian sources, the visit was aimed at putting in place steps for Syria's return to the Arab League through Egyptian and Saudi mediation. Meanwhile, Riyadh and Damascus have reached an agreement to reopen their embassies after the Muslims' holy month of Ramadan. Saudi Arabia says it is planning to invite Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to an Arab League summit that Riyadh is hosting in May. Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan is set to travel to Damascus soon to hand President Assad a formal invitation to attend the summit scheduled for May 19. From a different perspective, Israel sees its existence in tatters ever since Iran and Saudi Arabia decided to normalize ties. That could significantly be one of the most reasons behind an increase in the number of attacks against Syria. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is that Israel and its longtime ally, the United States, see no other option but to weaken the government in Damascus by any means, be it by pounding Syria with missiles and rockets or maintaining presence in the Arab country to plunder the country's oil riches. All can be considered as the West's attempts to keep Damascus in isolation, something which has so far proven to be otherwise.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed off on a new foreign policy strategy aimed at prioritizing the elimination of what it calls Western dominance in global politics. Addressing members of the Russian Security Council via video link, Putin said,
"Cardinal changes in international life have forced us to seriously adjust key strategic planning documents, including the foreign policy concept of the Russian Federation, which outlines the principles, tasks, priorities of diplomatic activity."
The Russian leader explained that the key document had to be altered due to what he termed as drastic changes in the international landscape. The new foreign policy outlines how Russia could take, quote, symmetrical and asymmetric measures in response to unfriendly actions against it. The 42-page document says to build a multipolar world, Russia would create conditions to counter any new colonial and hegemonic ambitions. The document was presented by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who in a televised address said Russia faces existential threats to its security.
"The existential nature of threats to the security and development of our country driven by the actions of unfriendly states is recognized in Russia's new foreign policy."
Lavrov said the United States of America is directly named as the main initiator and conductor of anti-Russia sentiment, and in general, the policy of the West aimed at weakening Russia in every possible way is characterized as a hybrid war of a new kind. He said that anti-Russia measures include undermining its military, economic, and technological potentials, as well as aiming to limit its sovereignty in external and internal politics to erode its territorial integrity. Lavrov underlined that Moscow will no longer rely on the West for energy trade and instead will shift its business toward China and India. The top diplomat's comments came as Moscow has voiced its readiness to maintain its strategic parity and peaceful coexistence with the United States and establish a balance of interest between the two. Nevertheless, the new policy document has made it clear that the prospect of such relations largely depends on the U.S. abandoning its domineering stance and giving emphasis on interactions with Russia. Moscow says it expects Western powers to recognize the futility of confrontational policies and hegemonic ambitions and to eventually return to pragmatic cooperation with Russia. Russia has clearly stressed that mutual respect should be the basis for dialogue and cooperation. Russia's new strategy package has stressed the need for boosting cooperation with China and India. It calls for the deepening of ties and cooperation with friendly, sovereign, global centers of power and development located on the Eurasian continent. Moscow has already stepped up energy supplies to both China and India after being almost entirely cut off from its traditional European markets. However, Russia's new policy document can also be seen in light of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent visit to Moscow. Undoubtedly, China and Russia share a common concern about the West that has been trying to isolate the two countries from East and West Asia, Europe to Africa under different pretexts. Russia has time and again warned the U.S.-led NATO against its eastward expansion, calling it an existential threat. Ironically, that was one of the reasons of Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. In West Asia, the U.S. continues to maintain its presence by deploying troops to the countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But its military adventurism is to instill fear among regional countries and to serve as a goal to encircle Russia. In East Asia, China has long accused the United States of trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From the military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan by the U.S. and its allies, it seems that Putin's argument about the West's attempt to create a global axis is closer to reality. Instances like China brokered diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Russia's move to stop the West's expansionism, are enough to suggest the need of a multipolar world order. This is something countries were deprived of due to the U.S. intentions to make a unipolar world to pursue its own agenda. But a change is taking place given that many countries like Russia, China, and India have proved themselves to be able to shift the global order.
Donald Trump has become the first former United States president to be charged with a crime. A grand jury in New York has indicted Trump after a years-long probe into his alleged role in covering up a hush money payment to an adult entertainer ahead of the 2016 presidential election. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, an indictment is the process when a person receives a formal notice that it is believed that they committed a crime and informs the person of the charges against them. It takes place after a grand jury examines all potential evidence to decide whether a crime was committed. If the jury decides there is enough evidence, an indictment will come. In this case, the grand jury in New York City, which has been meeting since January, indicted Trump after hearing testimony from a number of witnesses. The specific charges are not yet known, as the indictment remains under seal. Trump is expected to be arraigned on Tuesday. After months of hearing evidence concerning a $130,000 payment to adult entertainer Stormy Daniels before the 2016 presidential campaign, the grand jury voted to charge Trump. The money was reportedly meant to buy her silence about the encounter she says they had years before. Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, has said he coordinated with Trump on the payments to Daniels and to a second woman, Karen Dougal. The former president has denied the affair and any wrongdoing. He said the payment was to protect his reputation from a false accusation. While the particular allegations were not disclosed, multiple U.S. media sites speculated prior to Thursday's indictment that the probable charges pertained to Trump's reimbursement of Cohen, with prosecutors charging that he falsely labeled the payments as legal expenditures. The accusation, which is ordinarily a misdemeanor, could be elevated to a felony if prosecutors link the payment to violations of election law, which limits individual payments to political candidates to $2,700 and requires them to be made public. The payment to Daniels right before the 2016 vote could be considered an illegal campaign contribution. Trump also faces felony investigations related to the 2020 election and over the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by his supporters. Trump has rejected Daniels' claim, and his lawyer has accused her of extortion. Calling himself a completely innocent person, Trump described the indictment as the latest in a series of steps aimed at destroying his Make America Great Again movement. The former president also accused the Democrats who conducted the probe, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, of trying to hurt his electoral chances. Trump has denied any wrongdoing, describing the measure as political persecution and election interference at the highest level in history. A judge is anticipated to unseal the Manhattan charges in the coming days, and Trump will be required to turn himself in to authorities. He will then appear in front of a judge and be formally charged, after which a decision will be made as to whether he should be freed on bond or taken into custody. Legal experts say that any potential trial is still at least more than a year away, raising the possibility that the former U.S. president could face a jury in a Manhattan courtroom during or even after the 2024 presidential campaign as he seeks a return to the White House. After his indictment, Trump's supporters gathered outside his Palm Beach Mar-a-Lago property in Florida to show their support for the former president.
It's totally, you've heard a witch hunt. It's not going to stop here. We've got to continue fighting for Trump because they're going to continue going after Trump because they know he can beat any Democrat they put out there. So they're going to play dirty. They're going to do all the games they can play to get rid of Trump.
Meanwhile, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is thought to be strongly considering a 2024 presidential run, called the indictment an un-American move. In a tweet, he said the weaponization of the legal system to advance a political agenda turns the rule of law on its head. He also said Florida will not assist in an extradition request. In reaction to the indictment, Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, said in an interview that the indictment is an outrage.
Well, I think the unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States on a campaign finance issue is an outrage. And it appears to millions of Americans to be nothing more than a political prosecution that's driven by a prosecutor who literally ran for office on a pledge to indict the former president.
Also, Trump's former United Nations ambassador and candidate for the Republican nomination, Nikki Haley, said in an interview that the indictment was more a political move than a search for justice.
You know, from everything I've seen from this New York district attorney is that this would be something he'd be doing for political points. And I think what we know is when you get into political prosecutions like this, it's more about revenge than it is about justice. And, you know, I think the country would be better off talking about things that the American public cares about than to sit there and have to deal with some revenge by some political people in New York.
Political analysts say that the indictment would put Trump in the spotlight once more and could potentially boost his election chances by focusing all the public attention back on the former president. They say Trump will try to turn his indictment to his advantage by stoking anger among core supporters over what they see as the weaponization of the justice system.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
For American households without children, 14.2% of female single-headed households experience food insecurity, compares to 12.5% in male single-headed households. For households with children in the U.S., 27.8% of female single-headed households experience hunger compared to 15.9% of male single-headed households. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Truthout wrote in this regard, emergency food aid was slashed to pre-COVID levels this March in the U.S., forcing food pantries to scramble to meet a growing need. For 3 years, Sarah Wilson, a disabled 60-year-old living in rural Maryland, received $281 a month from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, better known as food stamps. Coupled with a $1,700 monthly Social Security disability check, the former social worker made do. She told Truthout, "My finances were manageable. Then they notified me during the second week of February, telling me that because of an 8.7% increase in my Social Security payments and the end of emergency COVID allotments, my SNAP will be cut to $23 a month beginning in March. Wilson sounds panicked as she ticks off her expenses. $1,000 for rent, $50 for the phone, and $91 for utilities. I don't have cable. I don't have Wi-Fi, and I had to let my car go because gas and insurance were so expensive, she said. Adding, there is no public transportation near me, so I'm basically homebound, stuck in the middle of nowhere. I try to use telehealth for doctor visits, but when I have to go in person, taking a lift costs $32 each way. It's as if the government suddenly decided to treat poor people as badly as possible. Wilson says that she will now rely on a local food pantry to deliver a small monthly food box, but worries about having to forgo high-protein foods that her doctor recommended. $23 is nothing, she said, adding, it's nothing. Wilson is just one of the approximately 41 million U.S. residents, one in eight people, to be impacted by the cutbacks. In fact, SNAP reductions effective March 2023 have hit every beneficiary, regardless of whether they are disabled, elderly, or school-aged. Responsibility for these cuts rests with Congress, which allowed the COVID-19 SNAP Emergency Allotment (EA) in effect since pandemic shutdowns began in spring 2020 to expire. These allotments gave individuals like Wilson an additional $250 a month for food. Families also saw a hefty increase, but now, thanks to EA expiration and an increase in Social Security payments, seniors and the disabled are facing a double whammy. Their increased income has reduced their eligibility for SNAP. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, the federal agency that oversees all government-run food and nutrition programs, SNAP emergency allotments were a temporary strategy authorized by Congress to help low-income individuals and families deal with the hardship of the COVID-19 pandemic. Although meant to offer only short-term help, the allotments proved to be an effective tool for stemming hunger. Researchers and policy analysts at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, a nonpartisan Washington, D.C. think tank, studied the program and found that EA kept 4.2 million people above the poverty line in the final quarter of 2021, the last period for which data is available, and reduced overall poverty by 10%. Child poverty, the CBPP reports, has increased. Hunger Free America, a New York City-based direct service and advocacy organization, predicted that the decrease will send people into a Grand Canyon of hunger. For its part, the USDA is well aware of the program's inadequacies. Even before the COVID, the federal agency recognized that 88% of SNAP recipients had trouble accessing healthy food. The major barrier, unsurprisingly, has always been cost. What's more, a USDA infographic acknowledges that 19% of SNAP beneficiaries live too far from grocery stores to shop in them. Even more damning, the same USDA infographic notes how much it costs to eat. The agency estimates that a healthy diet for a reference family, defined by law as an adult male and adult female between the ages of 20 to 50 with two children between ages 6 and 8 and 9 and 11 is currently at least $977.70 per month. Add in soaring food prices,
costs rose 3.9% in 2021 and 9.9% in 2022, and it's not hard to understand why hunger is on the rise in the U.S. Gina Platanino, SNAP Deputy Director at the Food Research and Action Center, told Truthout that inflation in the United States has made the cuts particularly devastating. She said, at a time when inflation is so high, the impact will be particularly acute for older people, the disabled, and households with small children. We need to protect and expand benefits and change the way eligibility for SNAP is calculated. The program needs to take into account special dietary needs so that people with diabetes, celiac disease, kidney disease, and other illnesses can buy the foods they need even if they are expensive. She added that SNAP also fails to account for widespread food accessibility issues. Guardian also reported Gina Melton is facing a dilemma in the United States. Like millions of other Americans, Melton and her family relied on food assistance benefits boosted by U.S. Congress to help them through the pandemic. Now that extra cash is gone. The reduction has hit them hard. Three of her family members are disabled, and one of her daughters works to take care of them through an agency. They had already relied on credit cards to pay for medical equipment that wasn't covered by the federal health insurance schemes, Medicare or Medicaid, but have had to stop paying a couple of them in order to afford food. Melton, 62, said, "When you have to choose between feeding your family and paying a credit card bill, you have to choose food." Around 42 million Americans are currently enrolled in Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program SNAP benefits. Congress increased the SNAP benefits in response to the COVID-19 pandemic in March 2020. The last extra payments went out at the end of February in the remaining 32 states that were still issuing them, in addition to the District of Columbia, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The emergency allotments were authorized in tandem with the COVID-19 emergency declaration in March 2022. But in December 2022, Congress passed a law to end the allotments. The lapse in the additional benefits will reduce SNAP allotments for the average recipient by $90 a month, with some households losing $250 a month or more. Older adults at the minimum benefit level will see their monthly SNAP benefits drop from $281 a month to $23. Though Melton's husband, a diabetic, is still recovering from a recent surgery, he has been considering going back to work part-time at the age of 65 as the family struggles to afford basic necessities, including healthy food. They have cut back on food purchases and buy what's on sale or in reduced price bins. Melton said, "The extra food allotment was helping us a lot. We have started shopping at lower priced stores that don't bag your groceries, but for a disabled person like myself, that requires me to go with a helper. We've also cut back on some more expensive necessities and are relying on the local food pantry more."
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Imam Ridha alayhi salam's shrine on the occasion of the beginning of the Iranian New Year 1402, that's March 21st, 2023. The Iranian nation has stood firm against a long chain of the enemy's conspiracies and schemes, against coups, against sanctions, against political pressures and media attacks. These media attacks that have been launched globally to cause Iranophobia and fear against the revolution are unprecedented. Such a thing has never existed to this extent. Which nation other than the Iranian nation has been able to stand against these security conspiracies? This is internal stability. This shows that the foundation of the Iranian nation is strong. A clear example of this that everyone has witnessed was the recent unrest that they started from months before. They started riots and got everyone involved. You see, these are points which are very important. The president of a country like the United States openly supported the country's internal riots. The presidents and heads of state of certain European countries also openly supported the riots, which included an extremely small percent of the Iranian nation, a very, very, very small percent.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They not only offered verbal support, but they also offered weapons, as well as financial and security support. They provided all sorts of help and support for these riots. They had prepared themselves to, at minimum, weaken the Islamic Republic. Their plan was to weaken the Islamic Republic, but what happened in reality was the complete opposite of what they had intended. The Islamic Republic proved to be strong, not weak. It overcame the riots and the global conspiracy and showed its strength to the world. The 22nd of Bahman of 2023 was more exuberant and crowded than all the other 22nd of Bahman rallies that took place over the past few years. This shows the internal strength of the Iranian nation. So, the Iranian nation has a strong and stable foundation, and one sign of this is that it has resisted and stood firm against great conspiracies. Another sign is the Iranian nation's great advancements. They do not want these words to be repeated. Mentioning and repeating these things makes the enemy extremely upset, but it is the truth. We have had achievements, which I will briefly mention, that were all accomplished during the sanctions, under the economic siege, and under the most severe, unprecedented economic pressures.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As International Quds Day approaches, large billboards with the theme of Iftar in Quds have been going up across the capital, Kabul. The goal is to support occupied Al-Quds and the Palestinian nation. People of Afghanistan consider Al-Quds as a source of religious unity and brotherhood against hegemonic powers or the global arrogance.
Quds.
Al-Quds is in the hearts of all Muslims, as it's the first Qibla in Islam. Palestine and Al-Quds are a factor for awakening and uniting Muslims. All Muslims should know that the global arrogance is behind the issue of Palestine, that makes Al-Quds a symbol of the fight against arrogant powers and bullies for Muslim nations worldwide.
Supporting the Palestinian nation is an issue that the people of Afghanistan have always insisted on. The people here hope that in the not-too-distant future, the Palestinian nation and the Holy Quds will be freed from the occupation of the Zionist regime.
I personally wish that I visit that area one day, but I hope that they come soon and that they Palestine and Jerusalem and every other area in that geography that once belonged to the Palestine, the state of Palestine and its people should be free.
The Israeli regime has in recent months stepped up its atrocities, killing around 100 Palestinians this year alone.
The people of Afghanistan are against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. This is also as they have endured tyranny and are familiar with the crimes committed during the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan for over two decades. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
In a shocking first, the United States has arrested and indicted their front-running presidential candidate and a former president, Donald Trump. Trump is charged with falsifying legal records related to legal hush money he paid in a salacious alleged affair. Polls show that 60% of Americans think the arrest was politically motivated, but many don't seem to mind, as 60% of Americans also say they approve of the indictment.
I agree. I don't think anybody should be above the law, and that's not from a, you know, oh, I'm glad he's going to be indicted. If it were a Democrat or Libertarian, Green Party, I don't care what stripe they have. If they break the law should apply to all of us.
It's considered the weakest of the handful of pending cases resulting from Trump's time in office, and it pales in comparison to other apparent crimes. Iran has issued a warrant for Trump's arrest on murder and terrorism charges related to the killing of Iranian anti-terror hero General Qasem Soleimani. Domestically, other recent U.S. presidents have escaped indictments even when they involve the death and suffering of millions of people, such as George W. Bush and Harry Truman. Richard Nixon got a presidential pardon for crimes committed against the United States. Bill Clinton destroyed Yugoslavia, and his wife Hillary gloated over doing the same for Libya. None of these leaders have ever faced a trial, but some hope that the prosecution of Trump will start a new era.
I do support it.
And I hope that, you know, going forward, that, you know, this is a testament to our, you know, our justice system, and that I think it shows that we are willing to, you know, go against the rich, even though, you know, he's rich and powerful. You know, our Supreme Court is willing to do what is necessary to put these people and hold them accountable. So I hope that we can continue to do this forward, going forward with other people, other political figures, and hold people accountable overall.